Amazon puts ebooks into paper libraries. The PlayStation Network hacked offline. And is Apple the new big brother? All that and more on the Slongcast. Everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Slongcast, episode 32 for Tuesday, April 26, 2011. This episode of the Slongcast brought to you by Goatsy at www.goatse.cx. Ryan, where is .cx?
I think it's Christmas Island.
So we have Easter Island with the big forehead statues.
Yep.
And now we have .cx for Christmas Island. What's on there?
I just looked it up. It looks like it's about...
Presents?
Yeah. It looks like it's a couple hundred or thousand miles off the coast of Australia.
Ooh. It's the land of misfit toys.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. It's a real place. And that, my friends, is Mr. Ryan Lancey with
Howdy.
Me as always.
Howdy doody.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Don't actually go to the website that I just mentioned for sponsoring the show. Please do not go there.
Yeah. Oh, this is kind of gross. There's a coconut crab that lives on Christmas Island. It looks like a giant, scary spider. Like, gigantic, like big as your head.
Who would have thought that on an island that sounds so nice, like Christmas Island, there would be such devilish creatures?
Yikes.
These people naming their islands, they do it backwards. So anyways, let's jump right into it. Top story of the week. Microsoft counts down to the death of XP. And... we all know that this is coming, but now Microsoft has put up a countdown clock that if you go to their site, you will see a big blue widget, for lack of a better term, end of support, 1,082 days, or it's probably less days by now, but they're counting down to the end of support in 2014. So, Ryan, I think I know your opinion on this, that this should have happened at least by now.
Well, I mean, it is 10 years old. But, I wonder, the end of life support, like, dates, they always go with the service pack. So, end of life for the original Windows XP is, like, long gone.
Yeah, and if you're still running SP1, SP1A, even SP2, I think you're out of support.
Right. So SP3 is all that's left. But, like, what if they, like, released SP4?
I don't think they would. I mean, they have Vista, they have Windows, they have two new operating systems out on top of it.
That's true.
That would be really dumb for them.
But if they did, we could get more out of it.
We should petition Microsoft to release an SP4. No new features, just roll up the updates, just so we get an extra 5 years of service.
Yep, that'd be awesome.
That would be totally not awesome.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's been a long time coming. I mean, the OS is already 10 years old. It will be... what, 13 years old when it finally falls out of favor? I mean, this is the equivalent of, say in 2001 when it came out, this would be the equivalent of them at the time using like Windows 3.0.
Wow, maybe even 2.0. Or wait, Windows 1.0 came out in 85, so that would have been up to 95. So yeah, maybe it was 3.0 that came out around 95.
Yeah. Well, it would have been, 2001 minus 13 would be 91, 88, whatever came out in 88.
Oh, so that would have been like Windows 2 or 1.5 or whatever.
Yeah, so wow. I mean, just to give you an idea of like how old this thing is, and everyone's complaining about this, like, I mean, if you go back to 2001 and you put yourself in the, in 2001, like, time frame, like, in your mindset, even then, Windows 3.1... seemed so archaic.
Yeah, for people my age, imagine starting college and having Windows 3.0, not even with networking, on your laptop.
You'd have to install Trumpet Winsock.
Trumpet Winsock.
To even get on the internet. And, I wonder if it would even work nowadays. Just something tells me that it probably... like,
I think so. I mean, it's a TCP/IP stack.
Yeah, but something tells me it just wouldn't work. Like there'd be something that like Windows... or Microsoft decided not to support back then that's like heavily used now.
I doubt that it would support, it definitely doesn't support QoS, no new TCP/IP flags or anything. It's probably just straight, the packet and nothing more.
And like, who knows, maybe like your ISP would just block you. Like, oh, I don't...
That could be.
These packets are bad. I don't want them.
It probably detects like weird header sizes coming in the packets. Like, whoa, that hasn't happened since 1995.
This must be a virus.
Skynet has come online.
I mean, that's just to put it in perspective. So, you know, I mean, yeah, everyone can complain all they want about it, but Microsoft is still the king of, like, long-term support and backward compatibility, and we got to give them a break every once in a while. This operating system is too old to be being used anymore.
Yeah, definitely. You know, give it props for what it was. It was the best operating system of its kind for clients, you know, when it came out, and it was for a long time, but it's over now.
Yep.
You know, there are more choices for Microsoft, and there are even other companies out now with more choices, so it's time to go away.
Yep, bye-bye.
Goodbye. So we talked a while ago about Twitter changing its terms and saying that people are not allowed to make Twitter clients, that all they do is mimic the functionality of the Twitter client. Now, Twitter is rumored to be buying TweetDeck, one of the major Twitter clients, for $50 million. Or 31 million, is that pounds or euros or lira?
That's pounds.
That's a pound symbol?
British pounds, yeah.
It's a funny L with a slash through it.
Yeah, the euro is like a...
Oh, it's a funny E.
It's a funny looking E.
Yeah. See, I always thought this was lira, but I guess not. But either way.
I think that L comes from the Latin libra or something. I think that's where that L comes from for British pounds.
I don't know anything about Latin, so I will believe you. But anyways, what do you think they're trying to do here? I mean, they already bought Tweety, and Tweety became the new Twitter client. If you download the official Twitter client, you have Tweety, what used to be Tweety. Now they're buying TweetDeck. Have you used TweetDeck before?
A while ago, not in a long time.
So you know basically what it is. You know, it's your normal Twitter client, but it gives you multiple vertical columns. So you have one for your normal feed that every Twitter client gives you, but then you also have a column for your at replies, a column for your direct messages, a column for searches, and you can add as many columns as you want to search for whatever you want. So it's a really good desktop client because it can take up the full screen and show you anything you want to see on Twitter. I see Twitter as making this the new Twitter client. I mean, I use TweetDeck all the time. Like, that's my client. I don't know if you guys can hear this on the show. You probably can't, but it's thunderstorming again.
Yes, again.
Just like last week.
It's a little scary. I just looked up the pound sign. It is Libra. It's the Roman unit of weight.
Oh, so pound weight. Yeah.
And it originally stood for, because it was the value of one tower pound of, I don't know what the tower pound is, but it was a tower pound of fine, pure silver. That's where the British pound comes from.
Huh.
And a tower pound is 334 grams, which is a lot less than a normal U.S. pound.
The tower pound is the general name for King Offa's pound, and it was based on the silver penny.
Mm.
The pound was based on the weight of 120 Arabic silver dirhams, which have been found in Offa's dike. What in the world?
This is, man, if you get into, the tower pound is equivalent to about 350 grams.
It was...
I mean, if you get into, I still like the U.S. measurement system, you know, and imperial units and all that. Like, I do like it, but some of the history behind it is just crazy.
Yeah. One mercantile pound is equal to 9,600 tower grains, which is equal to 6,750 troy grains.
Yeah, see,
what are these things?
Well, I know there's troy ounces in avoirdupois. Ounces.
There's a penny weight? What's penny weight?
And apothecary's ounces. There's different ounces. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that they weren't so much measuring weights as they were like volumes of a certain thing. You know? So like...
Jeez. There's a Russian funt and a skalpund. That's a Scandinavian measurement. Okay. I'm saying right now, we all need to go metric. This is ridiculous.
No, I don't think so.
This is just ridiculous. Everything makes sense in metric. You divide it by 10. Done.
Yeah, you do. But, you know, I've had this argument with, like, a lot of people. Like, A, we have universally accepted like a calendar that's not metric because we measure.
Is there a metric calendar?
Well, no. But I mean, the point is no one even thinks about it. And the reason they don't is because when you measure days and years and months, months are basically almost based on the moon cycle, but not quite. Like we measure them this way because they traditionally make sense and they measure something that's tangible. Like, you know, like for instance, everyone makes fun of it, like the way you measure a barrel of oil or a barrel of whatever. But, you know, when you say I have a barrel of something, you can picture an object that's roughly that size, you know? And then if you find out that a barrel is like 220 liters, and then I say, I have 400 million liters of gasoline.
What?
It's like, how much gasoline do you have? Like I don't know how much that is. And even if you know what a liter is, I can guarantee you.
I can't picture in my head 420 million.
Yeah, like I know about the size of a liter, but I don't know how much 420 million of it is. Like if I say like 80,000 barrels, like you could roughly like imagine what that would look like because you know what the size of a barrel is.
Right. And
like it just, I don't know. I think customary units measured things.
By comparison.
But yeah, by comparison to objects. And anyway, I don't want to get too.
Like a hand. Or a fathom.
Yeah, I mean, even like an inch.
It's I can't picture a fathom.
An inch is based on the width of a normal man's thumb at the first knuckle.
What about a Kevin's thumb? That's like a centimeter.
But that's roughly what an inch was, you know? And a foot is the size of a man's foot in a shoe. That was all, the average man. Like, so, you know, when you needed rough measurements, Yeah, not everyone had a ruler back in, you know.
Yeah, all the nuns had them back then, and they slapped people with them.
Exactly.
All right, so we've got a couple Facebook stories. So, supposedly, according to Rewrite Web, Facebook launches some new safety and security tools. Now, these were the tools we were talking about a couple weeks ago with the Facebook bullying and Facebook saying that they're going to be taking some steps to combat this and to give people the ability to report things. Well, now, apparently, they have. Have you seen these available on your page? I haven't seen them. So maybe it's a slow rollout. Maybe it's only available to younger people. You know, people under the age of 18 will see these. But now, whenever you report photos, you now have the option to say it's things like, yes, this is about me, and I don't like it, or the photo is harassing me. I like saying it like that. Or, no, this photo is about something else, and then you can say it's spam, it's pornography, whatever. Those options don't exist now. You basically just have the report this, and Facebook has to take care of it. So I think we pretty much got each other's opinion on these things and said they were a good idea. Did you see anything in this article that is in addition to what we talked about a couple weeks ago?
No, not really. I looked at their little method. To me, their method for getting rid of a picture you don't like isn't really all that. It doesn't give you any new options. Like, it lets you send a message to the person, it lets you block the person, or remove them as a friend.
Well, that wasn't there before. The remove as a friend was a manual process before. You had to do it on your own. Now it's like a one-click thing.
Well, no, I understand that, but they're all options you already have. It's
right.
Like,
they're just changing the way they present them to you.
Right, but it's like, okay, well, you know, in my opinion, if you're in a photo, if someone tags you in a photo, and that means that if they tag you in it and you contest it, there should be some maybe mitigation process where it's taken offline first, and then, you know, there's a sort of like a eBay resolution process where
Oh, I see what you're saying. So you're saying these options don't really mean anything because that photo is still there.
Right.
I see.
So if you did want to remove a photo of yourself, you know, whether, because sometimes it's not even it's not something that there are crazy situations where maybe you were doing something illegal and you don't want it to be on there. That's one example. But another example is just an unflattering picture that someone took of you. I don't know what rights you have as the person in the picture. Maybe none, because they're the copyright holder, but...
Well, the picture was taken normally in a public place, so yeah, you have no say over it.
I guess not.
Unless the picture was taken in your house, it's fair game.
Yeah, but like, I guess it would be nice if, I guess at least being able to untag yourself is nice, but
right.
It's just, it's unfortunate. Like, I think we're living in an age where we might have to think about, you know, more privacy in that way.
Well, see, that's the funny thing, because a lot of people are saying nowadays, privacy is dead. You know, there are cameras and everything. There are microphones and everything. If you live your life thinking that you have any amount of privacy, you're the most naive person ever. You know, you need to live your life assuming you don't have it. And unfortunately, that seems to be the case anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, ask my friends. I'm taking pictures of everything. If they do something stupid, I'm tweeting about it 10 seconds after they do it. So they probably hate me for that. But yeah.
You might find yourself not having many friends.
I always wonder why my friend count goes down on Facebook. So Facebook actually did something different in addition to this, what they call bullying prevention. We also mentioned how they changed the way the like and share buttons work, and that they both kind of do the same thing now. Well, now, and again, I haven't seen this, so it must just be a slow rollout. They have added a send button. So whereas the share button just posts a link or page to your feed and everybody sees it, the send button allows you to do that, however, only to people or groups that you specify. Do you see a use in this?
I think the design is a little dumb. Like, do they really need two buttons? It's like, make it a like button and then have a field that says this is visible to, and you can select everyone or delete everyone, or maybe it's filled in with everyone by default and you can put in friends' names or their groups, like this share button.
See, this is what bothers me, is they do that now. When you share a link, beside the share button after you click share, there's that little lock icon that you can set the privacy so only certain people can see it. Maybe nobody see, because I just shared a link today and I saw that.
Yeah, but it's that you can't change it after the fact.
No. After the fact, it's there.
Yeah, but I'm saying, like, when you hit the like button,
and that's the thing, the like button, you have no options. It's immediately liked.
Right.
But the share button, you have the option of setting privacy right then and there.
But I thought they got rid of the share button.
Whatever. Did they get rid of share?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what did I do? Because I went to a friend's Facebook page today who had shared a link, and okay, it wasn't a share button on a third party site. It was a share on a link already on Facebook.
You can do the post to Facebook thing, like that you can do.
Yeah, that's what I did.
So if you do a post to Facebook, you can select as you post it.
Right.
Like I'm looking at it right now. But like in terms of that like button, I don't know why they just didn't put a field at the bottom that's pre-filled out with everyone. So if you share it, everyone can see it. And then just if you don't want everyone to see it, just hit the drop down and select my friends, custom, just like you can in the privacy settings, you know?
Do you think that makes it harder though?
No, it's because it'll encourage people to hit the button and just hit save and then everyone can see it. But
however, with the like button, it's only one click. If you add this field, it's now two clicks.
Oh, whatever.
I know. That's my only thing that I can see them putting two buttons instead of one.
But I think putting two buttons on everyone's website is going to make people like, hey, you're taking up too much crap on my space on my website.
I already hate websites that I go to and I see the like button for Facebook, the this button for Twitter, the that button for this other network. Like so many people's websites, personal ones, have a billion social network, you know, dig it on dig, bookmark it to delicious, do this to Reddit.
Dig it.
Like, no, I don't want 37 social network icons on every article that I read.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. Facebook, just get rid of the buttons.
How dare you put stuff all over your free website?
Seriously. Stupid people. So Amazon is now blurring the lines between a library and a computer. Normally, libraries were for paper books. You would go there and pick out a soft cover or a hard cover or an encyclopedia. Well, now, Amazon is saying libraries are allowed to take ebooks on the Kindle and loan them to people. They've already had this feature on Kindle books for normal users. If I had a Kindle book, I can loan it to you for a maximum of 2 weeks. At the end of that 2 weeks, you lose it, I get it back. And, you know, I can't read it during those 2 weeks. But now they're giving libraries the ability to have these books and load them out the same way to the library's customers. So I see this as a wonderful thing. However, I can see, you know, publishers, people who make, because you don't make money off of ebooks like you do off of print books. I can see those publishers being up in arms.
Eh. I mean, it's still, they can only lend out one copy, right?
Supposedly. The article does not say, but if it works the way the normal lending works for normal users, then yeah.
Then I say they can't bitch, honestly. Like, if only one person can view it at a time, you can't, if you, and you can't make digital copies of it, then they can't, they don't have anything, I don't think they have a leg to stand on. It's the same thing as lending out a regular book.
Well, yeah, it's not that. It's just that in order to get the regular book, you would have had to pay a full hardcover price, which was 2, 3, 4 times more than the ebook price. Whereas now, that cost goes down by a quarter, a half, three quarters to get that initial ebook copy. So they're losing money on the initial sale.
They are, but their costs for the sale are lower. You know, like, it doesn't cost them anything.
Right, the costs are bandwidth for the original upload.
Well, and that's Amazon's deal. Oh, the upload. Yeah. But who knows how they deliver them to Amazon? They may deliver them on CD through the mail.
Yeah, really.
Which is, you know, they'd have to, I mean, they have to ship books around, you know, like.
I wonder if anybody has done that math. You know, does the literally zero cost of distribution for ebooks counteract the distribution cost for paperback books, being that ebooks are so cheap, paperback books are so expensive? Does the distribution cost make one more profitable than the other? Because it seems up to now, all the publishers have been complaining that ebooks make them lose money.
Well, I think it makes the revenues go down. I think, and I don't know that anyone, I'd have to go back and parse everyone's words to see if anyone claimed that they were making less money. But I think...
Well, less money if they would have only been selling printed versions.
But I mean, define making less money. Like, this is always misconstrued.
Like, I sold 10,000 books. 5,000 of them were ebooks. 5,000 were printed. Had those 10,000 been printed, I would have $1 million more dollars.
Right, but your costs are higher.
And that's what I'm saying. So, I mean, wonder if anybody has done that math.
Right. Well, I mean, and I think, I don't think anyone has to do the math. I mean, I just think that the costs of the print process, like the cost for paper, printing, running a print press, ink, then packaging the books, coming up with artwork for the front.
Well, artwork is still there.
Okay. Well, some of the artwork, but like all that stuff that, well, that's okay. Those are fixed costs. Let's just talk about the variable costs then. That's a good point. And the variable costs are paper, ink, running a printing press for an extra 5,000 copies or however many more you want to print. Then also packaging, like boxes for them, and distribution to
trucks, gas,
all that stuff. Yeah. All those things are gone, and I would say that's got to be, I mean, just knowing how other businesses are, that's got to be a large bulk of the cost.
Yeah, I honestly don't know. The reason I bring it up is because one of the recent books that I bought, The 4-Hour Body by Tim Ferriss, he's a good friend of Kevin Rose, he will not sell soft cover copies of his book because he makes a crap ton less money selling soft cover as he does hard cover. And while they were talking about it, he also brought up the idea of ebooks and that, you know, he's sticking with hardcover.
Hardcover only.
No, he also sells ebooks, but they were just talking about the fact that ebooks, you make so much less money per sale.
Why do you make more money on hardcover than softcover?
I have no idea, but apparently that's the way it works, is you charge so much more for hardcover and in the end you make more money. I mean, if I forget where it was on the Random Show that Kevin and Tim do every who knows when. If you go to Kevin Rose's blog, you'll find it. Yeah. One of the previous episodes, that's all they talk about is his new book, and you can listen to them talk about that.
I mean, my guess maybe is that the hardcover books, they command a price premium, and because they're in hardcover, they're probably more popular, so maybe the publishers give the writers a bigger cut.
I think that might have been it.
You know, but then if you think about, like, the soft cover books, like, they must be obviously less popular because now they're in soft cover, and we're not going to pay you as much per book, even though And additionally, the cost goes down. So,
yeah, and I don't know how this compares to music, but if you go to like online music and streaming music, there was a nice infographic that hit Dig about a week or so ago to show that, you know, for a band to make the equivalent of minimum wage, they would have to have like millions upon millions of streams per month on sites like RDO and other streaming sites, you know, Pandora, whatever, mm-hmm. just to make minimum wage. Whereas they would have only needed to sell, you know, 100 real albums, real CDs, you know, so they're showing
that. That's assuming they would sell the CDs and keep all the profit. But like,
well, no, they're counting in the cuts that people take. And that's why it's, you know, millions upon millions of streams, because they only get pennies per stream versus the large cut they get from a real product.
Yeah, but don't they get like something like 40 cents per download from iTunes?
And there was different categories in there, like an iTunes download, an Amazon download, a stream from Pandora, a stream from RDO, this from that. Yeah, they had it like 10 or 12 different categories.
But I mean, you can equate, in my opinion, you have to compare apples to apples. Like streams, you have to really just compare to airplay. So like the royalty checks come in for years and years and years from the radio airplay that you get from your music. It's not a whole lot of money. It's definitely not as much money as you'd make from touring or from the CD sales.
And so here's the graphic. I just found it. For an artist to make minimum wage monthly,
okay,
they must sell 143 self-made CDs, 155 CD albums. Now, these are both, you know, their own distribution. If they were to go retail CDs, they would have to sell 1,100. If they were to have downloads, they would have to sell a little over 12,000 downloads. If they were to get streamed on Rhapsody, almost 900,000 streams. If they were to get streamed on Spotify, 4.5 million streams. So that shows the difference in the music area of electronic distribution versus real distribution. 1,100 albums versus 4.5 million streams, or even 12,000 downloads. I wonder how that compares to books in the same way, electronic versus real.
Yeah, that's interesting because
this was on Mashable if anybody wants to go find it.
I can understand where there'd be a big disparity between self-made CDs and online downloads, you know, like maybe a 10 or 100-fold difference, because, you know, Apple's taking a cut and the studio's taking a cut if it's a studio produced album.
It's like a 1,000-fold difference.
Right. But what I don't get, that seems big to me. But what I don't get is that it's also saying that an Apple, like an iTunes download is also like way higher. You need to sell way more than a studio produced album. That to me doesn't jive. Like, because everything I've read about the industry says that the studio albums are, you know, they completely rape the artist
I don't think I get what you mean by a studio album compared to.
So did they have studio albums in there?
They had retail album.
Okay,
an album that the band sells out of their suitcase versus an album that is in Walmart or a store.
So which one's which? Retail is in Walmart.
Yeah, yeah.
Produced by a studio, it's like sold by Geffen Records or something.
Yeah, yeah. You have a label.
Okay, and how many did you need for that?
1,100.
Right. So there's a 10-fold difference between that and iTunes, and that doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, so for a retail album that costs $10, the label gets $2, the artist gets $1. The rest of it is production costs. For an Amazon or iTunes download that is $1, the label gets 63 cents, the artist gets 9 cents. So as you get to more and more digitized delivery, the artist gets less and less money.
I mean, I'll have to look it up, but that totally disagrees with stuff that I've read before. Like, I remember when iTunes first came out, they said they were given something like 40 cents to each artist for every download.
I don't know.
I mean, I'm not trying to call you a liar, but
I really don't know. That totally doesn't jive
with my...
Yeah, they list their sources at the bottom, so you can check them out if you want to, but yeah, they're saying that a download.
Because that was my whole reason for supporting the electronic music industry versus CDs, is because from what I understood, they were getting just hosed on the CD contracts.
Well, that, I guess it depends on where you get it from, because they're saying here under format as CD Baby. Does that make sense to you? What is that? I've never heard of that. Because they have two different types of downloads. They have, crap, I just clicked on it. They have MP3 download as a category. Then they have MP3 download via iTunes. And then they have track download from Amazon or iTunes. Those are three separate categories. I don't know what the difference is.
Okay, well, what does the artist make on an MP3 download from iTunes?
That's exactly what you said it was.
40 cents.
The label gets zero. The artist gets 57 cents.
Yes, okay, so...
But what is this track download where they specifically list Amazon and iTunes?
A track download. Maybe if the whole album's been purchased or something?
No, because they have a separate category for that.
I don't know, but if you ask me, like, if I'm an artist, if I'm going to get 57 cents per song download, or $2 for a CD, for a whole CD, like if I'm going through a studio.
$1.
Or $1 for the whole CD, it sounds to me like the best bet is iTunes.
Yeah, well, look at it this way. There's another category for an entire album downloaded via iTunes. The label gets $6.29. The artist gets 94 cents.
For a whole album?
Yep. So they make more on individual track downloads than they do whole album downloads.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Those numbers sound so whack.
So music industry aside, this is what makes me wonder whether books are the same way. Whether the writers are getting screwed from ebooks like the music industry or the artists are in music.
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. But either way, that's on Mashable. Just search for digital music infographic, and you can find that, and the sources are at the bottom, so you can double-check their math. But I don't know. If it made it to Mashable, I'm going to agree with it.
Yeah, but I mean, even within that source, we're finding that on a per-track basis from iTunes, they get 57 cents, but if they download the whole album, they get 90 cents? That doesn't make any sense to me. Yeah. I mean, that's just... I mean, I'm not saying they're lying, but that just doesn't make any sense.
Well, that's the RIAA trying to screw everybody.
Yeah, okay. Anyway.
So, apparently now, your IP address can pin you down to your location within a half a mile. So, I just wanted to throw this in there. I really didn't want to talk about it that much, but we all knew that, you know, somebody has your IP address. They can pretty much tell, you know, what city you're in, where you're at. Well, the reason I put this article in here is because some researchers now have found other ways to do this. So they take your IP address and they start doing multiple trace routes and pings. And they're actually kind of using a Google Maps approach where they find out multiple routes to your IP address from different places on the internet. And they figure out which one goes faster, which one goes slower, where the speed differs. What are major points, like major structures around where they think it is, and they can pin you within a half mile now based on your IP address. And the reason I bring this up is because this isn't magic. Like, all it takes is one of these guys to spend half a day, write up a little tool that they put on the internet, and now everybody can do this and track people just on their IP address. So it was just kind of a scary thing. You know, for those, you know, we talked at the top of the show, assume you have no privacy. You know, this is another thing, really. Have you heard about this method that they're using?
I did read somewhere else, I think it might have been Slashdot, that they mentioned that researchers were using the speed of light to somehow calculate where you are based on IP address. But I didn't, this had way more detail than that initial article that I read.
Yeah, this... What they bring up as a bad point, you know, they don't even really talk about the privacy, as in somebody can stalk you. You know, this article on Ars Technica says now websites can give you deals, you know, ads for the burger joint across the road because they now know where you are in relation to the road.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's kind of crazy that they even know which city you're in, you know, and
right.
And now they know, like, not only the neighborhood, but damn near the street.
Yeah, because previous to this, all you knew was the colo. So if somebody had an IP address and you did a who is on it or something, you could figure out where that batch of IP addresses terminates and goes out to residential houses. So for some people, you know, it might terminate in Northern Virginia, but be delivered to a house in Altoona. So mm-hmm. normal people would think that these people live in Virginia because that's where the internet says that IP address is from, because it can't go any further than that main right. juncture point. But now, not the case.
Well, I mean, they could get your they could get the locations of the local routers too, to get you much closer.
If they wanted to, do trace routes and do things like that.
Because more than likely, you're going to hit a router within probably 100 miles of your house.
Yeah, I was just talking like normal Whois data to find out where.
Because they've been able to locate to city level for quite some time.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, but I remember when I found out about how Google was using Skyhook, to do the Wi-Fi location, because I had downloaded an early version of Google Maps. This is back when I had a Windows mobile phone, and it was able. I knew that phone did not have a GPS chip in it. I guess it did, but Verizon had disabled it. It was one of those phones, and it somehow knew where I was. And I was like, "How does it know where I'm at?" And I realized that I had the Wi-Fi turned on much after this point. And I went and I found out about it, and then you could actually get the coordinates. You could get your GPS coordinates of like your house if you wanted, and then put your IP or your router's MAC address into Skyhook's database. You like your local.
I remember that.
Yeah. So I had done that, and what's really cool is as more and more people did that with their you know, they used to like send people out with cars to like collect the data and then put it into the Skyhook database.
And then Germany sued them.
Right. but now we'll talk about that later in the show about what else, how they sped that process up. Now, even if you're not attached to the wireless point, if your phone can see the wireless point in its lists, it can use it for a location point, which is cool.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's really cool. So
we have a couple audiovisual style stories. The first one we talked about last week, as I was complaining that I got Portal 2 for my PS3 and couldn't also download it on my Mac because PlayStation Network was down and I couldn't link my PSN account with my Steam account. Well, I assumed it was anonymous, and the general consensus on the internet is yes, it's anonymous. They're not really taking credit, but yeah. Anonymous is attacking them. Sony has come out and said, yeah, we've been hacked. And because we've been hacked, we have shut down the PlayStation Network. And I just tried today before the show, still offline. So literally, I tried this on Tuesday. Last Tuesday, when Portal 2 came out, it was offline. It has been offline consistently until this Tuesday, still offline. The only change is that for the past week, it has given some weird error code. Now it says PlayStation Network is down for maintenance. But in addition to that, Sony is saying they are not even sure that our credit card data is safe. So for those of us who have stored our credit card data with the PlayStation Network to do purchases through your PS3 or whatever, they don't even know whether Anonymous has breached their systems far enough to steal credit card data. WTF.
Yeah.
Like, how do you not know this?
Well, I mean, I guess if you screw up somebody's network enough, they can't get in to get the data to determine what was breached and what wasn't.
Oh man, this is ridiculous. I mean, I don't use PSN.
Not good news.
Yeah, I don't use PSN, so my credit card is not on there, so I really don't care. But there are a lot of people who do. I mean, you know, the PlayStation Network is just like an app store on the iPhone or the marketplace on Android phones. You can download $5 games, so a lot of people do that. And mm-hmm. Sony is basically saying, yeah, not only are we down, but you might need to go get a new credit card. So that's all I had to say about that. I didn't know if you wanted to ream them out.
Well, I mean, it's hard to say I told you so. I mean, it's not like I had anything to do with this, but it's like, I mean, they're doing some pretty unscrupulous stuff, I think. They were
asking for it.
Well, yeah. I mean, they're also not only asking for it. I mean, you can say, you have to be careful with that argument, but, you know, attacking someone who has not done anything malicious to you, and trying to enforce copyright or whatever where you don't have a right to do so, removing features that people really liked, you know, they dug their own grave here.
They took somebody to court based on the slippery slope argument.
Yeah.
You know, that shouldn't be allowed, and Sony did it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's no wonder that they got hacked. So our next story is something very interesting. I think you might have a lot to say about this. I kind of do. But we all know that we can, you know, watch movies on demand, no matter what service you have. DirecTV, Dish Network, Comcast, whatever. They all offer on demand. But we can't get movies that are in theaters. Those are reserved for theaters until at least a couple weeks after. Well, DirecTV released last Thursday their premium video on demand demand service, which basically lets you get those movies for $30 per watch.
Ouch.
Now, here's the question, and this is probably their question. Would you rather go to the movie theater and pay $10 per ticket if you're taking a family of four? So $40 plus popcorn and drinks, come out of there $60 to watch a movie on the big screen. Or would you rather watch that exact same movie at the exact same time for $30 from your couch? Which one would you choose?
I mean, I like the experience of going to the movies.
I agree.
I do. I like it. I don't go. I mean, I don't know really if movies are charging too much or not. I mean, they're roughly like $8. You know, when you factor, people complain about the food, but it's true that the theaters make no money off the movies. They have to make money somehow, and the food's how they do it. And it's hard to make a lot of money, especially given the size of those places. You know, you got to pay heating bills and whatever else off $2 candy,
right,
and a dollar soda. So, I don't always go and buy everything that they sell, but it's just, I guess what I'm getting at is I don't really fault the industry. People still go, and it's, you know, a lot of people don't find a problem paying it. You know, they still go.
Well, I think it's the screen size factor, you know? Like, sure, I could pay, you know, $20 less to watch the movie that is only in theaters at home, but it's not the same. You know, you right. go to the movie theater for a reason.
Yeah, I mean, you do. And like I said, I mean, I like going to the movies. That said, if I had a really nice home theater, you know, like, I mean, really nice. Like
projector on the
projector
wall.
Projector screen and, like, nice couches and, you know, good surround sound and all that stuff. Because, I mean, honestly, I think the surround sound in, you know, in my little tiny living room is way better than any of the local theaters. I think it, you know, the local theaters have been very inconsistent in their upkeep of their sound systems, and it's to the point of distraction for me. You know, the quality was so bad it distracted from the movie. You know, plus those reels of film, they're only supposed to be viewed so many times, and you overuse them, so the quality of the film itself deteriorates.
Well, that's what bothers me, is that they still use film. Seriously?
Yeah. Well,
like, come on.
I mean, there's I don't think that's really what matters, but
it's,
you know,
not. But I,
you know, the quality is there with film if they're using newer reels, but they do wear out after, you know, 30 or 40 views or however many it is. But anyway, I think there's still something to be said for the theater experience. You know, I don't have a family, so I'm not going to get hit like on a $50 charge every time I want to go to the movies. But also the list of the movies, I don't think they were all very, were they all like family type movies? I thought a couple of them were like more like,
well, they said they only listed a couple that they were planning to include: the Adjustment Bureau, Cedar Rapids, Hall Pass, all PG-13 or above.
Yeah, so like
they're planning on, you know, if it's in the movies, it's on DirecTV Premium. That's the point.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I don't go see movies very often. I just saw a movie yesterday. I saw Water for Elephants, and I wouldn't have wanted to watch that at home. Yeah. You know, it was a movie about a circus, pretty much. I won't spoil it for anybody, but you get that from the previews. And seeing the elephants life size, you know, the size of an elephant on a big screen, that kind of makes the movie. I wouldn't want to watch that at home. I'll pay the $10 a ticket for that. I don't think I would ever pay $30, especially when it expires in 24 hours.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
I mean, the movie industry is definitely going through a lot of changes, much like the music industry. And there's a certain fixed amount of numbers they have to deal with. You know, there's only like so many screens in the United States. Like, I want to say like maybe 25,000 screens or something like that. Like, that's what a movie might open on.
Right.
And if you take that number and multiply it by a ticket price and so many people, you can start to get an idea of like the total budget that a movie can really, what they're limited at, you know, if they want to make a profit.
Yep, just trying to make some money.
Yeah.
YouTube now, see, this article kind of confused me at first. The article is YouTube videos are now served in WebM. You know, we talked about this probably months ago, the new video codec that Google is trying to get standardized and get everybody to use. And I thought, what in the world is YouTube doing converting all their videos to WebM? Who uses WebM? Why is this out there? And then I remembered, oh yeah, Google owns YouTube. It's Google's codec. Yeah. That's why. I have nothing to say about this other than I think this is a waste of time.
Well, I mean, do you see some advantages to this? Won't this let them move away from Flash?
HTML5 and H.264 does that now. I can watch pretty much anything I want to on my iPhone and iPad with H.264.
So did you sign up for that HTML5 trial?
No, I don't have to for some reason. Like, if I watch something on my iPhone or iPad, the videos just work.
Oh, so they must have, like, updated their website.
Yeah, like, they just play. And it's the same for, you know, Vimeo and lots of other websites. Like, I literally have not noticed things not working on my iPad because I don't have Flash.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't understand. I completely forget what the benefits to WebM were, and I don't think anybody else remembers either. You know, H.264 does everything you need.
Yeah.
So whatever, YouTube, do what you want. So our last AV article, the point I wanted to make on this from CNN Money, 7% of Americans subscribe to Netflix. That wasn't the point I wanted to make. The point I wanted to make is basically the initial line of the article is that Netflix has more subscribers than Comcast.
Yeah, they have more subscribers than anybody. Anybody.
And this is kind of what Comcast was dreading.
Yeah.
You know, this is what the TV industry was dreading.
I still wonder how Netflix remains relevant going forward, though. I mean, they're just a middleman at this point. You know, once the studios figure out that they can just serve up these movies right from their studio, you know, I mean, what do they need Netflix for?
That's true. But is it better to have one entry point to video content or 12? One for each studio.
Right, but I mean, that assumes that you want Netflix to be the gatekeeper for the rest of time.
Well, Netflix aside, forget about Netflix. Is it better to have one gatekeeper, or is it better to have 12, one for each studio?
I that's what I'm saying. That's assuming that Netflix would remain the gatekeeper going forward. Like, or someone remains the gatekeeper. Do you want only one choice? Because that's what it's barreling down. You know, where what we're headed towards. Now, it might make sense if there were a couple competitors to Netflix, and there are kind of, but you know, if there were like two or three like similarly sized companies, maybe roughly like our wireless choices, like an AT&T,
right,
a Verizon, and then a couple smaller companies like Sprint and T-Mobile, that you know were providing this service, that they would contract with the studios and determine their own revenue models and the best way to offer content to users, then you'd have a little bit of choice. But I think I don't think we want a single point of entry.
I agree with that.
You know, 12 may be too many.
That's what I'm arguing against. You know, NBC, CBS, ABC, you know, every studio, I don't want to have to pay a $3 a month subscription to feed ABC, NBC, CBS, you know, 12 subscription fees, 12 websites I got to go to when I want to watch content. I want it in one place.
Right. Well, I don't understand why I have to pay subscription fees to any of these.
Well, I mean, yeah, I agree
like,
with that.
You know, like, I don't understand why they can't wrap in the advertising like they do with TV. Like, fine, make it so I can't skip the ads in this TV show. Fine, it'll work. That works for me.
It'll be just like TV. Yeah. No big deal.
I won't care. I won't. It, you know, like in 1985, I watched the commercials. If I still have to watch the commercials, I'll still watch the commercials. I don't mind it. I don't mind it. Now, maybe the value of advertising has just dropped because, you know, as Matt Hunt said on the show before, you know, you've got companies like Google that are proving the how good the ads are to their customers and how terrible other kinds of advertising are,
right?
In terms of like how well they do. So maybe that's why it's not working for them online. I don't know, but like I haven't had to pay for primetime TV shows all my life if I didn't want to. I get cable for other reasons, you know, but
right. I have an antenna. I can get ABC, NBC, CBS for free.
Right. You know, so I've been getting them free for 50 years. I don't know why I can't get them free on the internet with wrapped up advertising. I'm not saying you can't advertise to me. You can advertise all you want. You can even, you know, I don't know, whatever you want to do. You want to advertise, fine, no problem.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. But I still hate, now this is different from my hating web advertisements. I hate TV advertisements because more and more TV shows are becoming like mini movies. There's a big story arc. Things flow as if they were meant to be seen, you know, 45 minutes start to finish. And they interject these commercials and it totally breaks up the feeling of the show. And I hate it. I literally hate it.
It's like, fine then. Put, you know, do placed ads like where they're holding cans of Pepsi when they drink stuff.
No.
I don't.
Well, okay, if they don't call focus to it, maybe.
Here's the thing, though. If you want a movie or a TV show to be realistic, they have to use everyday items.
No, like, I agree with that. I'm just saying, like, you know, don't have them go take a drink because they're thirsty and then say, oh, this Pepsi is delicious.
No,
I don't want those kind of ads.
I think that's kind of, yeah, that's definitely cheesy. I agree. But I mean, you know, showing, like, for instance, the guys on Big Bang Theory all drinking Mountain Dew. Like,
yeah, I have no problem with that.
Right. And it's an advertisement for them. You know, it's
you know, Mountain Dew is paying them a lot of money for that.
Yeah. And you see them drinking Mountain Dew and it reinforces like, oh yeah, I love Mountain Dew.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't even care if there was like 2.5 minutes of ads before the show and 2.5 minutes after the show. I just don't want the show broken up because there are so many good dramas now that I just get totally taken out of the show when a commercial comes on.
Well, that, or maybe the directors just have to like say, okay, this is how they're going to fund our programming with advertisements. So I have to design the show to have like maybe an intermission sort of thing, like where it's got act one, act two type deal.
Yeah,
This goes back to, you know, Shakespeare. Like
he's been dead for how many hundreds of years and he's still relevant.
Yeah, I mean, plays have acts. I think this is the way drama, like the way acting and movies and all this, it's how it should be.
Well, let me bring up a counterpoint. I can see an argument from the directors and the people writing the shows being, yeah, we do that, but our acts are half a season. Like an entire season is a show to us. And we have to break it up in hour clips because that's what TV lets us do. Yeah, I don't know. I just wanted to argue more. So our next story, we had always complained about Windows Phone 7 being out and them not updating it ever since it came out. Well, they finally started to update it for Focus and Quantum owners. A memo came out, the NODO update, N-O-D-O, for select LG and Samsung phones. I shouldn't say select LG and Samsung phones, select LG and Samsung users. So you could have an LG Quantum and still not get the update. But it will come out eventually, but they finally released an update that adds in things like cut and paste and other things that Windows Phone 7 was missing. Do you think they're behind now? Do you think this is too little too late for Windows Phone 7?
I don't, because it's still really, really early. We're talking about an operating system that came out in the fall.
I agree it's early for Windows Phone 7, but it's not early for smartphones, and they are just the last one to the game.
Well, they are, but I mean, I disagree that they're the last one to the game. I mean,
who else is there? Apple's there? Android's there?
I mean, Microsoft has been making mobile operating systems for smartphones for close to 10 years now.
Sucky ones.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it doesn't matter. The industry started out really sucky, and it got better and it got better. And for a long time, no one could compete with what they offered. And then obviously they get leapfrogged, and everyone copies the leapfrogger. And I still think that the interface that Windows 7 offers is, it's still, or Windows Phone 7 is very unique. It has a lot to offer. I am basically just waiting for it to come to Verizon, which it may never do. But like, if it does, and it's an LTE phone, it's something that I would, you know, definitely put in as a contender. Like, none of the stuff that this update addresses is the reason I'm not considering Windows Phone.
It's very little things, but...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if I were an AT&T customer, I probably would have already looked at it and, you know, maybe even bought one. But, you know, I'm not switching.
So here's a question. You mentioned how good you think the interface is. Since Samsung is now getting sued by Apple for copying the iPhone interface, many, many, many patents they're being sued by Apple for. Do you think companies like Samsung will now try to come out with phones copying a Windows 7 style interface with tiles or similar things to tiles, like they copied the iPhone? Do you see other companies trying to copy Windows 7?
They may, but I think that building upon that argument that Apple's making is flawed. Like, I'm almost certain that Apple's patent won't hold water.
Oh, see, I think the exact opposite.
Like, their patent is for an icon-based desktop. You can't patent that.
No, their patents are for... They're suing based on trade dress.
Yeah, the trade dress is based on that page with icons on it, which is Windows 3.1, which is Mac OS, which is every OS since
the GUI's
been...
Have you seen the comparison, though?
I've seen the side-by-sides. Yes, they're similar.
They are exactly the same.
They're not exactly the same.
I mean, the color gradient might be off by a couple pixels. The gray might be slightly darker in one, but they clearly copied everything.
Yeah, but the patent doesn't define all those colors.
Well, the patent defines multiple rows of four icons with colored icons and a dock at the bottom, and the Samsung phone that they're suing them for copies this to the T. Like, everything the patent defines, this phone copies.
Well, the Samsung runs Android, and the dock's at the top.
Not on this phone. It is exactly the same as iPhone. Dock at the bottom, four icons at the bottom, multiple rows, looks exactly like the iPhone.
Well, they might be able to get them on that, I guess. But it's just these patenting these GUIs. I mean, I just don't think you can patent it. You can't. If you try to patent anything with icons. Like a color-based icon interface.
You need to sue Xerox or whoever invented the icon that Windows stole for three.
That's what I don't get about it. Like, everyone's like, Apple's like, oh, they're so innovative. No, they're not. They don't innovate. They put stuff together and make it work well.
They're integrators.
They're very good integrators. That's a good point. Very good integrators, but not very good innovators. Then you have Microsoft come along with this tile-based interface. It's completely revolutionary. Like, totally different from every other GUI we've ever seen.
It looks nothing like any phone that's out there now.
They get very little credit for it, you know, and the only credit they do get is just that it's you know, it's wild. It's totally different. But like, no one does really like a usability study or anything on it. And, you know, and now, so Samsung makes a phone that's very similar to the iPhone using Android, and then they get sued by Apple. It's just, it's like, you couldn't have written it any better. Because you just know this is the way they work. I mean, but from what I've read, Samsung's suing Apple in like four other countries.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess if Apple, there were some predictions that after Steve Jobs leaves the company, or goes his own way or whatever, that that Apple's just going to become an IP firm. And the more and more this happens, I see them turning into like basically an IBM.
Yeah.
You know,
you wonder if Steve is the guy with the ideas and there is nobody else there.
Well, again, I don't think it's ideas. Like, I don't think Steve Jobs is an idea man. I think Steve Jobs is a perfectionist and he's an execution guy. Like, he can make it work. He can sell it. You know, those are not that you can succeed on ideas alone. I think you do need the Steve Jobs type to integrate it and sell it. But he's definitely, I just don't see him as an innovator. I've never seen him as an innovator.
Well, innovator or not, the iPhone wouldn't have happened without him. That was his idea. You know, Mac OS X, that interface, you know, that was him. Without him, will Apple make anything that is different like they have in the past? Whether it's an innovation or not, you know, once he goes away,
Will they make as good a product?
Right.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, who knows? So in addition to iPhones and iPads and suings and stuff, AT&T finally came out and said what everybody has known for the past 3 or 4 years. Our network can't handle the traffic generated by the iPad and iPhone. They basically didn't say that like I said it, but they are admitting that, you know, they have network capacity constraints more severe than those of any other wireless provider. So, yeah, they're basically, you know, they never mentioned the iPhone or the iPad, but that's the reason. There is absolutely no other reason. You know, there's no other device on their network that could be doing this, but they basically admitted that their network sucks and they know it. And I'm going to agree with this because I was at my parents' over Easter. My sister has a Verizon iPhone. I have an AT&T iPhone. I downloaded the speed test app on both of our phones, ran them both side by side in the same place. My download speed was 0.04 megabits. Hers was 0.97. What the heck?
That's a pretty big difference.
Yeah. I mean, she had 3G Verizon service. I had Edge AT&T service.
Well, I mean, Edge is definitely slower.
But that's what I mean. Like, AT&T isn't even good enough around here to get me fast data, a fast network, let alone fast throughput on that network.
Yeah.
Yeah, nothing else to say about that. So one of the big stories that just came out in this past week is that people finally realized that cell phones collect data on where you were. I would like to say, duh. But it came to light this week because some researchers found on iPhones that there is a file in the backup. Every time you sync to iTunes, your iPhone gets backed up into one large package. And when they uncompressed, unzipped, whatever you want to call it, that package, they found a file that contains GPS coordinates of everywhere you've ever been. And this has made a lot of people mad. And more so because some dude made a tool that will plot all these on a map with frequency bubbles to show you where you've been and how often you've been there.
Yeah.
Do you have anything to say about this other than duh?
Well, I mean, we knew that there were, I mean, I think there was a lot of people that knew that they would collect location data and send it back. That said, Apple isn't very forthcoming about that. You know, like, from what I've read, and I don't have an Android phone, but from what I've read, when you set up the iPhone, I'm sorry, when you set up an Android, it asks you several questions on the initial setup, and one of them is, you know, hey, we're going to collect location data. Is that okay?
iPhone does that too.
It does?
Exact same thing. The difference is iPhone does it really like once when you set it up, you know, turn on location services or turn it off, and then once per app.
Okay.
So Android, whenever you install an app, you know, they tell you a breakdown. We're using this. We're turning on the microphone. We're using GPS coordinates. Like, yeah. iPhone doesn't do that detail.
Right. Well, right. But I'm saying, but like, even like the first time you power up you buy an iPhone, the first time you turn it on, and is there like a setup process?
No, just works.
It just works. See, but I think with an Android, when you do that, there's some setup questions. And one of them is, hey, we're going to collect location data. Is that okay?
And if you say no, it turns off the GPS?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it turns off the GPS, but it doesn't collect the location data and send it to Google, from what I know about it.
Yeah, I don't know anything about Android.
There's a couple of things that this is not the end of this today. Like, regardless of what Kevin and I decide. I mean,
no, what we say is written in stone.
This will not be the end of it. I can tell you that this is going to be a gigantic issue over the next couple months because already congressmen are involved and there's questions out, queries to both Google and Apple about it. No one's answering questions. Like, Wired couldn't even get responses from Apple.
Well, Steve Jobs sent a dude an email and said, Google does it too.
Yeah, he says, oh, yes, they do. It was probably the most snide response I've seen from Steve Jobs, if it really was from him.
Oh, I'm sure. Like, Steve sends.
I know, but I'm just saying, it was really snide.
Yeah, some dude sent him an email and said, talking about Android, they don't track me. Steve's one-line response, oh, yes, they do. We don't track anyone. The info circulating around is false. And I think that is the case. You know, this data that they're sending back isn't sent back all the time. It's like a once every 12-hour thing that they send anonymized data back. So they're not tracking you. They could care less who you are.
How is it anonymized? Like
they don't link it to your whatever that number is.
Yeah, they make up a random number. But yeah. I mean, if you could truly make up random, I mean, if it's truly anonymized, then they've done something that. You know, there's only so much you can do to anonymize it.
Okay, sure. But they're not sending back your IS whatever number.
But if they know the secret, if they know the algorithm of how it's randomized, they may be able to deconstruct that.
Or they could be using something like, 256-bit AES, one-way hashes that you're not decrypting.
That's true. I mean,
But either way, all phones do this. Android does it. The only reason why this is a big deal is because somebody found the file on the iPhone
The other big deal is that they're saving the history indefinitely.
Yeah, it's...
And they're backing it up on iTunes. And it's like, why are they doing this?
Yeah, so here's the funny thing about that. You mentioned indefinitely, and that is kind of true. You know, pretty much ever since the iPhone had a GPS chip, they have been logging this. It's only until recently with iOS 4... Yeah,
that it's become visible.
That it has become a file that you can find.
Right.
But that file still has data from ever.
Before, yeah.
Like previous iPhones. If you've backed up the phone on the same computer, that location data is carried over to your new iPhones.
Yeah.
So,
and there's some rumors going around that this was a bug, that this is a mistake. They didn't mean to cache it.
No.
Which is bull.
It's not a bug.
Because there's a patent for this exact thing, filed by Apple.
Ways to track people.
What's the date on it here? September 3rd of 2009 is when it was filed. They had it on Slashdot today. So, they can't claim this was a bug. So they purposely wanted to track this. Why they felt it was a good idea to keep the cache on the forever is beyond me.
Yeah, I don't understand that.
I mean, they say that it would aid with location services and that it wouldn't need GPS to find out where you're at. Like, it could use the cell tower that you're connected to or Wi-Fi to like get your location.
Right.
But and it wouldn't even need a working network connection. Like, as long as it had the MAC address,
right,
and this database, you could come up with a rough location. So that's cool. I mean, it's one way to do it. But do you need to keep 2 years worth of data in there?
Well, you know who this does aid? Police.
Right.
And that was one of the supporting articles for this article. Is in Michigan, they actually show you a picture of the device that Michigan police are taking around. And they have cables that can connect to pretty much every smartphone, every phone with a GPS chip. And it will, for all intents and purposes, break into your phone by whatever means it needs to and download all data, pictures, logs, this GPS information. So, this is something that standard police officers are carrying with them. So if you get pulled over for DUI or something and you have to give them your cell phone, first thing they're going to do is probably hook it up to this thing and download all your data.
Yeah, mind you, the ACLU has... first of all, they filed a request with, which was it? Was it Michigan? Yeah, Michigan. And they replied that they would gladly provide the information to them for a payment of $554,680.
Yeah, like, really?
But, I'm always not a fan of the ACLU, but here I'm just like, this is awesome. Yeah. They need to go after this.
They need to get the EFF involved.
They do, and because there's another thing that they've been doing a lot of people don't know about, is that anyone, including U.S. citizens, entering the country, Department of Homeland Security has been, and I guess has the right to now, I don't know if they actually have the right, but they've been granted the ability to do it, is to scan anyone's electronic devices and download all the data off of it.
They can do that unless you have it encrypted. And then you do not have to give up your encryption password.
Right, because that's like Fifth Amendment stuff. Yeah. But they're still violating Fourth Amendment. I mean,
well, there's that.
Yeah, I mean, this needs to stop. Like, I know everyone out there is afraid of terrorists.
The terrorists are not going to win.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
But everyone's afraid of, like, you know, crime and everything else. But you know what? There is nothing in the Constitution that guarantees our safety. We are not guaranteed safety. All right. And I would like it to stay that way. I want to be guaranteed freedom, because freedom's what is really important. And safety is something that the government is supposed to try to provide, but I do not want to live in a country where, you know, we can't do anything.
Right.
So this stuff needs to stop. Like, they are violating civil rights left and right. You know, just like the Patriot Act. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I normally hate the ACLU, but in this case, you go, girl. I would love. Okay, this is going to sound weird, but I would love to be pulled over and have them pull out this device so that I can say, you can't use those results unless you provide me the source code for the device so that I can verify it works.
Yeah.
Because they have to give it to you then if it goes to court.
Yeah.
You know, just like people did with the breathalyzers. They had to give the dude the source code for the breathalyzer to verify that it was not doing something inaccurate.
Right.
So I would love for somebody to do that and get the code for these things to see how it knows how to break an iPhone, how it knows how to break Android, you know, what it's doing.
Oh, I guarantee those are, like, you know, protected or something, but whatever.
Yeah. So either way, our last article of the day, the iPhone 5 will be a dual-mode global phone, confirms Verizon's CFO. That's right, folks. The Verizon CFO let it slip that the next iPhone will work on any network, anywhere, ever. Mars.
Including iDEN.
It will work everywhere. And they're also, most rumors that are out now are saying a September release date instead of a June release date like normal, which I am okay with if it's an LTE phone. And you've probably heard me say this for the past 12 Slongcasts. As soon as the iPhone comes out as an LTE phone on Verizon, I am switching. And that is definitely the case.
Yeah, I mean, if they don't come out with an LTE phone this September, they're really going to, I think they will run the risk of getting leapfrogged. Like, it's getting to the point where they will not be the cutting edge. I mean,
yeah, because what is out that's LTE now? There's the Thunderbolt. Is that it? Is that the only one that's right now?
There's a couple, I think, but that's the only one that I know of, like, that's really popular.
Okay, so let's just say two or three right now. So if they don't release an LTE phone, by the time next June rolls around, every other carrier or every other company will have 3, 4, 5 LTE phones.
Well, yeah, I mean, Motorola's already planning to release a couple.
They'll be left in the dust.
Yeah, they're all going to have something this fall. And when you look at the rollout plan for Verizon, you know, with LTE, it's really only maybe a year out for most of the country. Yeah. Less.
Heck, Johnstown's going to get it by the end of this year.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're going to get it, everybody else is going to get it soon.
Yeah. So, I mean, this really needs to be an LTE phone.
Yeah. And even by that time, you know, sometime next year, AT&T will hopefully be rolling out their actual 4G LTE network, and maybe other companies or other carriers will be rolling out LTE instead of fake 4G like they have now. But yeah, if it's LTE, I will switch in a heartbeat. I don't care what they charge me to kill my AT&T contract midway through. I will switch right now. So have you seen any other articles?
I noticed a story on Engadget about Sony releasing two new Android Honeycomb 3.0 tablets.
I did not see that.
Yeah, there's the S1... they call it, in the S2. The S2 is a weird dual screen configuration, like that Kyocera phone.
Oh.
So it's like a tablet that, like, splits open.
So it's like the Microsoft Courier.
In a way, I think it's more meant to be like a horizontal split versus a vertical split.
Oh, like a top down instead of a book.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not that it couldn't be used like a book, but it just, that's how they showed it. But the S1 looks really slick. Time will tell on that, but it'd be interesting to see Sony, because Sony has a good bit of marketing power, for them to come out with something on Android, this could really boost.
Well, they have a good bit of something with all the crap they've been pulling.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they've shown their ability to do integrated devices with the PlayStation and miniaturize them. Yeah.
And is it, what does Sony have? What e-reader does Sony have?
The I think it's just a Sony e-reader is what it's called.
So isn't that a color e-reader? Like I think it's actually a decent device, like whatever theirs is.
I don't remember. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
I haven't really followed the e-reader market too much. A friend of mine got a Nook, and he likes it a lot, the color Nook.
A lot of hackers like the Nook because you can root them and make them a regular Android tablet.
Yeah.
I use Kindle just because I have the Kindle app on my iPhone, my iPad, my Mac, Windows machine, so the same book goes with me everywhere. And I like it. I mean, I don't have an actual Kindle.
Yeah.
Which is kind of funny, but yeah, I don't know. I'm not a big reader, so that was even a step for me to buy a book and read those words, whatever they're called. So nothing else you found interesting? I think we pretty much hit everything that happened this week.
Yep.
All right. So as usual, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slonkack. Ryan, if people want to find you, where do they go?
You can find me at www.lancipedia.com or at Twitter/RyanLancy.
Definitely follow us both up. You can meet up with us whenever we go to the South Side for drinks.
Yep.
Because we always tweet where we're at. If you want to bookmark something for us to talk about on next week's episode, next week will be episode 33. So bookmark it on Delicious, Slonkcast 033. And have a wonderful rest of the week. Dovidzhenya.